The Big Apple, New York, New York. I worked in the city the first 3 years of my advertising career. I was at J. Walter Thompson Company, which was the first and largest advertising agency in the world. And during that time, I, of course, became very familiar with the New York skyline. The Chrysler Building, the Empire State, the Hudson River and Brooklyn Bridge. The most dramatic change, as you know, came with the takeout of the Twin Towers on 9/11/2001. Max Lucado visited that scene a few days later. He describes it this way. See the hole in the skyline? I leaned forward and followed the finger of the driver. He was a rotund guy named Frank, neck too big for his collar, hands too thick to wrap around the steering wheel. He pointed through the windshield at the forest of buildings called Lower Manhattan. The towers used to sit right there. I could tell he knew I couldn't see the spot. See the hole on the left of the one with the spire? 3 days ago, that was the World Trade Center. I looked at it each day as I came over the bridge. It was a powerful sight. The first morning I entered the city and saw no towers, I called my wife and cried. To reach the epicenter of activity, we drove through layers of inactivity. Empty ambulances lined the road. Loved ones mingled outside the family care center where the USNS Comfort, a hospital ship, sat docked. Everyone waited, but each passing second took with it a grain of hope. Three checkpoints later, we parked the car and walked the final half mile. A week earlier, this road had been full of flannel suits and cell phones and stock market quotes. But on this day, the sidewalk was muddy. The air was thick with smoke. I decided not to think about what I was inhaling. I didn't expect the fires. In spite of the rain and truckloads of water, flames still dance. I didn't anticipate the adjoining damage. Neighboring buildings were devastated. Intact windows were very rare. The next door Marriott had been gutted by the cockpit of a jet, and any other day it would have been made the cover of a magazine. But most of all, I did not expect the numbness. Not theirs, not mine. A flank of yellow-suited firemen, some 12 or so in width, marched past us. The same number walked us toward us. Shift change. Those coming were grim. Those leaving were even more so, faces as steely as hearts and beams that confined their comrades. My response wasn't any different. No tears. No lump in the throat, just numbness. Several thousands were under there, I told myself. Yet I just stared. The tragedy spoke a language that I had never studied. I half expected and even wanted to hear someone yell, "Quiet on the set," and see actors run out of the ruins. But the cranes carried on. No cameras, just concrete. Later that night, I spoke with an officer who guarded the entrance of the family care center, and he was posted next to a plywood wall of photos, a wailing wall of sorts, on which relatives had tacked pictures and hopes. I asked him to describe the expressions on the faces of the people who had come to post those pictures. Blank, he said. Just blank. They don't cry? No, they don't cry. And you, have you cried? Not yet. I have to push it in. Disbelief for many was the drug of choice. We can relate. Calamities can leave us off balance, confused. Max reminds us that, consider the crisis of Joseph's generation. Now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. During this time, Joseph was struggling to reconcile with his brothers, and he was also navigating a catastrophe. It had been 2 years since the last drop of rain, and the sky was endlessly blue, the sun relentlessly hot. Animal carcasses littered the ground, and no hope appeared on the horizon. The land was a dust bowl. No rain meant no farming. No farming meant no food. When people appealed to Pharaoh for help, he said to them, go to Joseph, and whatever he says to you to do, do it. Joseph faced a calamity on a global scale. Yet contrast the description of the problem with the outcome. Years passed, and the people told Joseph, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. The people remained calm. A society that was ripe for bedlam actually thanked the government rather than attack it. Makes a person wonder if Joseph ever taught a course in crisis management. If he did, he included the words that he told his brothers in Genesis 45, 5 through 7. God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you. Joseph began and entered his entire crisis assessment with references to God. God preceded the famine. God would outlive the famine. God was all over the famine. God, famine, God. How would you describe your crisis? The economy. The divorce. Doctor's diagnosis. Do you recite your woes more naturally than you do heaven's strength? If so, no wonder life is tough. You're assuming God isn't in the crisis. He is. Even a famine was fair game for God's purpose. Writing in Never Give Up, Max remembers a memorable breakfast with a friend. Most of our talk revolved around the health of his 14-year-old son. 7 years before, a tumor had been found behind the boy's spleen. The discovery led to several months of strenuous prayer, chemotherapy. The son recovered. He played high school football, and the cancer clinic is now a distant memory. The discovery of the tumor was part of the story that I found fascinating. When the boy was 7 years old, he was horsing around with his cousins, and one of them accidentally kicked him in the stomach. Acute pain led to a hospital visit, and an alert doctor requested a series of tests. and the tests led the surgeon to discover and then remove the tumor. After the cancer was removed, the father asked the physician, how long had the tumor been there? Although it was impossible to know with certainty, the tumor, its form and size, indicated it was no more than 2 or 3 days old. So I said, God used a kick in the gut to get your boy into treatment. God doesn't manufacture pain, but he certainly puts it to use. 1 Timothy 6:15 said, God is the blessed controller of all things. His ways are higher than our ways. His judgments are unsearchable. His paths are beyond tracing out. We can't always see what God is doing, but can't we assume he's up to something good? Joseph did. He assumed God was in the crisis, and then he faced the crisis with a plan. He collected grain during the good years, redistributed it in the bad. And when the people ran out of food, he gave it to them in exchange for money or livestock or territory. After he stabilized the economy, he gave the people a lesson in money management. Genesis 47:24, give 1/5 to Pharaoh and use the rest for farming and eating. The plan could fit on a little index-sized card. Save for 7 years. Distribute for 7 years. Manage carefully. Could the response have been any more simple? Could it have been any more boring? Some flamboyance here would be nice. A little bit of a Red Sea opening. Jericho's walls tumbling, a was dead Lazarus walking. A dramatic crisis requires a dramatic response, right? Not always. We equate spirituality with high drama. You know, Paul raising the dead, Peter healing the sick. Yet for every Paul and Peter, there are a dozen Josephs, men and women who are blessed with other skills, skills of administration, steady hands through whom God saves people. Joseph never raised the dead, but he kept people from dying. He never healed the sick, but he kept sickness from spreading. He kept a plan and he stuck with it. And because he did, the nation survived. He triumphed with a calm, methodical plan. Jerry Vines, in his expository Bible on Genesis, writes, God has a lasting purpose in everything that comes into your life. As we study the life of Joseph, we have every indication that he had given his heart to the Lord as a young man and had lived for the Lord all the days of his life. And now we see in his closing days what God does for those who live for him, serve him throughout their days. First, Joseph experienced the delights of God in his closing years. Genesis 50, verse 23 says that Joseph lived to see his grandchildren. And as you know, the children of your children are very special. And Joseph must have been quite a grandfather. I can see him lavishing his grandkids with treats, and I'm sure he took them special places. And in the closing years of Joseph's life, he was experiencing the delights of God. But Joseph also expected the deliverances of God. Joseph knew that he would soon die. He also knew that God would one day take his family that had migrated to Egypt and bring them back to the promised land. And thus he told them, verse 25, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. Joseph didn't want to leave his bones in Egypt. The Jewish people would be able to say, see those bones of our forefather Joseph? One of these days, just as he promised, God will visit us and lead us out of this land of Egypt. When he does, we'll be able to take that box of bones and carry it into the promised land. And according to Exodus 13:19 and Joshua 24:32, that's exactly what happened. Continuing as his personal testimony, Jerry Vines adds, being a Christian is great. I'm so glad I'm saved. I'm going to heaven when I die. I will have a resurrection body and live in heaven forever. I'm so glad that I have a Savior who will take me all the way out of this world into the next. In the days leading up to the war with Germany, the British government commissioned a series of posters. The idea was to capture encouraging slogans on paper and distribute them about the country. Capital letters and a distinct typeface were used in a simple two-color format. The only graphic was the crown of King George VI. And the first poster was published and distributed in September 1939. Your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution will bring us victory. Soon thereafter, a second poster was produced. Freedom is in peril. Defend it with all your might. And these two posters appeared up and down the British countryside, on railroad platforms and in the pubs and stores and restaurants. They were everywhere. A third poster was created, but never distributed. And more than 2.5 million copies were printed, yet never seen until 60 years later. When a bookstore owner in northeast England discovered one in a box of old books he had purchased at an auction, the poster, which was large size, simply read, "Keep calm and carry on." And the poster bore the same crown and style of the first two. It was never released to the public. However, it had been held in reserve for an extreme crisis such as invasion by Germany. And the bookstore owner framed it, hung it on his wall. It became so popular that the bookstore began producing and identical images of the original design on coffee mugs and postcards and posters. Everyone, it seemed, appreciated the reminder from another generation to keep calm and carry on. Of all the Bible heroes, Joseph is the one most likely to have had a framed copy of that poster in his office wall. He indwelt the world of ledgers and flow charts and end-of-year reports, tabulations, calculations. Day after day, month after month, year after year, he kept a cool head and carried on. And you and I can do the same. We can't control the weather. We aren't in charge of the economy. You can't undo a hurricane or unwreck a car, but you can map out a strategy. Remember, God is in this and every crisis you face. Ask him to give you an index-sized card plan, two or three steps that you can take today. Seek counsel from someone who has faced a similar situation. Look for resources. Ask friends to pray. Reach out for a support group. More importantly, make a plan. And make sure that plan is bursting with hope. Let me conclude with a critical question. Do you believe no evil is beyond God's reach? That he can redeem every pit, including the one you may find yourself in? What if Joseph had given up on God? Lord knows he could have turned his back on heaven. At any point along his broken road, he could have turned sour and walked away. No more. I'm out. Well, you and I can give up on God as well. The cemetery of hope is overpopulated with sour souls who have settled for a small God. Don't be among them. God sees a Joseph in you. Yes, you. You in the pit. You with a family full of flops and failures. You incarcerated in your own version of an Egyptian's jail. God is speaking to you. Your family needs a Joseph, a courier of grace in a day of anger and revenge. Your descendants need a Joseph, a sturdy link in the chain of faith. Your generation needs a Joseph. There's a famine out there. Will you harvest hope? Distribute it to the people? Will you be a Joseph? Trust God. No, really trust him. He'll get you through this. Will it be easy and quick? I hope so, but it seldom is. Yet God will make good out of each mess. That's his job. Your job is to never give up. See you later.